Just as the Saltillo men were sure all problems relating to the islanders' community had been resolved, Coras, supported by two cronies, marched to the Presidio with yet another startling demand. We were promised that if we left our secure homes and ventured into this wilderness, we would henceforth be called, because of our bravery, Hidalgos, with right to the title Don. I am to be called Don Juan, he is Don Manuel Deniz, and that one is Don Antonio Rodriguez. In Spanish society, the word Hidalgo carried significant connotations. It was composed of three small words, hijo de algo, which meant literally son of something, or by extension, son of someone important. And it was impossible for even a minor member of the nobility like Don Alvaro de Saldaña to dream of calling men like Goras and his illiterate peasants Don. The soldiers, and most of the friars, flatly refused to do so. But Goras and his islanders threatened new lawsuits if they were denied their honorific. Since they had already flooded Guadalajara and Zacatecas with petitions, they fired this one at Mexico City itself, demanding that the commandant draft their protest on his own stamped paper. This was too much. Goras, if you give me any more trouble... Before he could complete his threat, the one-eyed islander demanded in a loud, offensive voice, "And where are those grinding stones the king gave us? I suspect you stole them, and I'm starting a lawsuit to recover them." The commandant had never heard of the promised grinders, but some months later they were delivered to Saltillo with a specific message from the king that they were to be sent on to his loyal subjects at Besar, with this added instruction: "In accordance with promises made on my behalf, all male heads of families who left Lanzarote for this dangerous undertaking are to be known henceforth as Hidalgos and are to be addressed as Don." In this manner, the civil settlement of Tejas was launched, with the Canary Islanders becoming aristocratic Hidalgos at a stroke of the king's pen. Fray Damian was a saintly man, but he was no saint. No sooner had he championed the Canary Islanders in their demand for an irrigation ditch and helped them start it than he summoned his carpenter Simon Garza and their two best Indians to an emergency meeting. "Before the islanders dig their ditch and draw off their water, let us deepen ours all along the way." As the work progressed, he found to his surprise that Simon Garza was frequently absent from the ditch, and Damian began to believe that the carpenter, always so faithful, was scamping his duties. Such unlikely behavior was so agitating that Damian began watching Garza more closely. One morning, when the carpenter had sneaked away, Damian followed him to the larger of the two mission barns, where he expected to find him sleeping while the others worked. Entering quietly by the main door, he adjusted his eyes to the darkness and moved to where a shaft of sunlight illuminated a cleared corner. And there Damian saw what amounted to a miracle, a true miracle brought down to earth and given form. Working in secret, Garza had hewn and bonded together three oaken planks, scraping and smoothing one side of the resulting board until it was quite even. From the long board thus created, he had sawed off seven large squares of wood and had begun to bond three other oak boards together to form a second long board from which he could saw off seven more squares. Suspended from a nail above his workspace hung a painting done in Spain of one of the 14 stations of the cross, those panels displayed in all churches showing scenes of Christ struggling through the streets of Jerusalem on the way to his crucifixion. Garza had taken this sample from the mission church. Below it, on a kind of horizontal easel, rested one of his first seven squares. With such tools as he had been able to improvise, Simon had nearly completed his carving of the third station, in which the solitary figure of Christ falls to the cobbled pavement of the Via Dolorosa, weighed down by the heavy cross he must bear. Below the figure rose from the wood the words, Jesus cae por primera vez. Jesus falls for the first time. With an innate appreciation of what oak could represent and of the mystery of Christ's passion, this unlettered carpenter was creating a masterpiece. For the figure of Christ seemed not only to rise living from the oaken surface, but also to proclaim its religious significance. And there was the mystery. The Christ that Garza had carved was indeed living, but not in any realistic way. If, for artistic purpose, the arm holding the cross required lengthening, he carved it so. And if the head needed to be cocked at an impossible angle, he cocked it. Indeed, as he studied that painting in the darkness of the barn, he had intuitively corrected each wrong thing. He had held to the good basics and discarded all that was meretricious. Simone's third station was not Indian art or primitive art or any other kind of art capable of being designated by an adjective. It was art itself, simple and pure, and Fray Damian could only gape in awed respect. Bowing his head in reverence, he could visualize the 14 completed carvings on the walls of his church, and he knew that they must become the chief treasure of Béjar. Humbly, he faced his carpenter and said, Surely God is working through you, Simon, to give us this miracle. Henceforth, I shall dig your ditches, and you shall complete your carvings in this barn. In many ways, the year 1733 represented the apex at Misión Santa Teresa, for the peaceful Indians near Béjar had learned to live within the compound and to listen to sermons, even though they showed no inclination toward becoming Christians. At the ranch, Fray Domingo had achieved great success with his cattle, and a limited one with his Apache. Indeed, he had two of them singing in his informal choir on those occasions when they wandered by the corrals to inspect the Spanish horses they hoped to steal on their next night raid. Relations between the mission and the Presidio, always a measure of how things were progressing, had never been better. The Saldana brothers had seen to that. Surprisingly, the religious contacts with Zacatecas and the governmental with Mexico City were also unruffled. It was a time of peace, especially with the French to the north, and Fray Damian could have been forgiven had he taken pride in his custodianship of the most important mission in Texas. He did not. His innate self-depreciation prevented him from accepting praise for what he deemed his ordinary duty, and on some days he almost castigated himself for not achieving more of God's work. However, his relationships with his brother and sister-in-law had never been better. For these three sensible adults, Damian, aged 47, Alvaro, 38, and Benita, 29, had evolved a routine which produced great satisfactions. On two or three days each week, Damian took his evening meal with his brother's family, bringing with him such produce from the mission farm adjacent to the church as he felt he could spare, plus cuts of meat from the animals that Domingo had brought in from the ranch for slaughter. Benita, on her part, would have her Indian servants bake bread and occasionally a fruit tart if the mission orchards had provided plums. The three would bow their heads as Damian asked blessing, and then engage in chatter about the doings in Béjar and Saltillo as the platters of food circulated and the bottle of wine was opened. Whenever a problem of management arose regarding either the mission or the presidio, the brothers would consult. But often it was Benita who offered the practical and equitable solution. She had developed into one of those extraordinary women who find in the rearing of a family and the organization of her husband's day-to-day life a key to her own happiness. She had never been overly religious, and saw no reason to depend upon the rewards of an afterlife to compensate for disappointments in this. She had been reared by her Spanish parents to believe that the greatest thing that could happen to a woman in Mexico was to marry some incoming Spaniard, make him a good wife, and in later years go first to Spain and then to heaven. In the wilds of Texas she had begun to doubt whether she would ever return to Spain, and she had long ago decided to leave heaven to God's dispensation. Sensible as she was, she had always known why Damian wanted to stay close to his brother and why he now brought gifts rather more lavish than conditions warranted. She knew that Damian, thinking of her as his spiritual wife, was joined to her with bonds so powerful that neither imagination nor death could dissolve them, and she felt obligated to him. He was her responsibility, and by her acquiescence she knew she had accepted the pleasant burden of his emotional life. When he was ill, she tended him. When his robe required mending, she sewed it. When he told little jokes about the mission Indians, she laughed. And whenever he appeared at her house or departed, she showed her pleasure at his arrival or her sadness at his going. In Benita, he had a wife without the responsibility of one. Was Alvaro aware of this unusual triangle of which he was a silent part? He never alluded to it. He welcomed his brother with more than brotherly affection, and saw no unpleasant consequences from what might have been a dangerous arrangement. Partly this was because Damian was so helpful, not only with his food contributions, but also with his attention to the three Saldana boys. He played games with them and taught them their letters, and often took them to the mission when Fray Domingo was in attendance so they could learn to sing. Invariably, when he visited their home at the Presidio, he brought them little presents, sometimes so trivial they could scarcely be called presents, but so thoughtful that they proved his continuing love. He had always been especially fond of Ramon, a bright, eager lad, now 11, and thirsty for knowledge of the world. Damian had long ago surrendered his silly hope that Ramon would one day become a priest. That boy would last in a Franciscan college 1 week, Benita, or maybe one day. Take my advice. Make a pirate of him. On Sundays and high holidays, everything changed. For now the Presidio Saldanas entered Damian's world, and they were properly reverent, for no one could live at the edge of the wilderness without speculating upon the nature of the good life, and orderly religion was seen as one of the abiding consolations. When Damian prayed, Alvaro listened, and when his brother preached, the commander followed his arguments. At communion, which carried special weight when one seemed so far from civilization, Alvaro, Benita, and their eldest son accepted their wafers solemnly, knowing that by so doing they were somehow in contact not only with Jesus Christ, but with fellow Catholics in Mexico City, Madrid, and all other respectable nations of the earth. On those occasions when Fray Domingo came in from the ranch to lead his Indian choir, Alvaro sang with them in his strong baritone voice, and at such times the three adult Saldanas often looked at one another, assured that a bond of friendship and love held them together. They would never see Spain again, none of them, but in Texas they had discovered the joy of lives decently led and work well done. On the 5th of September, 1734, a day that would be remembered with horror, a little Indian boy half ran, half staggered up to the gates of Santa Teresa with a story that only a child could tell without retching. To the ranch belonging to the mission, Apache had come, scores of them, and with systematic barbarity had burned every building and driven off every animal. The mission Indians who had tried to defend the place had been slain. The children, all nine of them, had been taken captive. And the five women. The little boy had not the words to describe what had happened to them. The Apache undressed them. Then they cut them apart. Fray Damian clutched at the back of a chair. They what? They cut them apart. And the boy showed how first a finger had been cut away, then another, then a hand and a foot and a breast, until the final rip of the gut, deep and powerful, from left to right. "Mother of God," Damian cried, and immediately sent Garza to fetch Captain Saldana. And when the brothers faced the boy, they asked, "What happened to Fray Domingo?" And now the child burst into tears. "When they were not looking," he said in his Utah dialect, "I ran to the bushes by the river. I hid there all day, and when night came, I am sleepy." "Of course you are," Damian said gently, taking the boy onto his lap. "But what happened to Fray Domingo?" "Upside down, by the fire, his feet tied to a limb, no clothes on. They built a fire under his head. Each woman puts a stick on the fire to make it blaze, then cuts away a finger or a toe. He screamed." The boy shuddered and would say no more. The Saldana brothers knew they had to organize an expedition to punish the Apache, and if possible, retrieve the captured children and any young women who might have survived. A force of 30 soldiers, 16 Spanish and mestizo laymen, 2 dozen Indians, and 4 friars set out for the Santa Teresa ranch, where the smoldering buildings bespoke the ruin that the Apache had wrought. Not even halting to bury the corpse of Fray Domingo, still hanging from a tree, the infuriated men picked up the trail of the Apache and spurred ahead. For 3 days they sought to overtake them, but failed. However, just as they were about to turn back in frustration, they heard a whimpering in some bushes and found the 7-year-old sister of the boy who had escaped. When it became apparent what indecencies the Apaches had visited upon her, several of the fort soldiers began to vomit. That was the nature of Béjar's endless struggle with the Apache. The familiar Indians of this part of Tejas, the Pampopa, the Postito, the Orejone, the Takame, the dozens of other tribes, were semi-civilized, like the more amenable Indians the French and the English were meeting along the Mississippi and the Atlantic seaboard. Europeans could reach agreements with Indians like the Mohawk, the Pawnee, and the Sioux, for those tribes understood orderly behavior. But the Apache did not. Their rule was to strike and burn, torture and kill in the cruelest ways imaginable. No persuasion touched them. No enticement tempted them to live harmoniously with anyone else, white or Indian. They were a handsome people physically, lithe, quick, remarkably at home in their environment, and capable of withstanding the greatest duress. They could go days without food or water. They could withstand burning heat or sleeted trails. And if they were horribly cruel to their captives, they could themselves accept torture with insolent defiance. They were the scourge of the lower plains, ravaging Tejas and venturing frequently all the way to Saltillo in the south, a city they loved to plunder. Sometimes they traveled 400 miles in order to steal an especially fine string of horses. But they liked mules, too, for these they slaughtered and ate. But even when there was no prospect of capturing horses, they raided white settlements just for the pleasure of killing people they knew to be their enemies. And when a district held no white people, as most of Tejas did not, they raided the camps of Indians weaker than themselves, slaying them indiscriminately. When Fray Damian rode back to Rancho El Codo to bury his longtime associate and dear friend, he was well aware of the serious undertaking he was about to launch. directing Simón Garza to climb the tree and cut the cord that kept the charred remains of Fray Domingo swinging by its ankles. He caught the body as it fell, and staggered with his burden to a proper spot, where a grave was dug. As the body was deposited, he uttered a prayer and made a promise. Brother Domingo, friend of years and warmth to my heart, you died in an effort which brought joy to God. I promise you that I shall take up the burden that you have put down. I shall not rest until the peace you sought is brought to the Apache, and they are safe in the arms of Jesus Christ. He proceeded in an orderly manner to fulfill his oath. Simon, halt your work on the stations and carve a fine plaque showing the martyrdom of Domingo, and this we will send to our colleagues in Zacatecas. To his Indian helpers, Candido, I must leave to you the completion of our ditch and speed it. Ignacio, I can't ask you to live at the ranch, for that's too dangerous now that the Apache have struck. But you must move through the countryside and rebuild our herds. For himself, he must quit the mission walls and move out among the Apache to bring them God's word. But before he could leave, he must find someone to guide Misión Santa Teresa temporarily. And he recalled the devout Fray Eusebio, who castigated himself so severely. After gaining approval from the head of Eusebio's mission, he installed him and smiled as the young dreamer lashed himself with his flagellum, crying, I am not worthy of such high promotion. In the months that followed, Fray Damián was sometimes seen by military expeditions, headed north or south from Béjar, and scouts reported back to Captain Alvaro. There we were, loneliest stretch we'd ever seen, Béjar 2 days distant. And out of nowhere comes this gaunt, long-legged friar on a mule. You must be careful of the Apache at night, he told us. They'll steal your animals. We asked him where he was going, and he said, to the Apacheria. And that was where he went. And because he moved alone, on a mule and unarmed, a man approaching 50, they gave him entry to their camps. When he had learned enough of their language, they talked with him and explained that it was impossible for Indians and white men to live together. They acknowledged that he personally commanded powerful magic, but they also pointed out that they were no longer powerless. Those you call the French, beyond the rivers, they sell us guns. Soon we shoot. Better hunters, you never catch us. He was so astonished to find that the French were supplying arms that he told the tribe with whom he had been living and to whom in the evenings he had been preaching, I must leave you now and tell my brother at the fort that peace with the Apache must come before everyone has guns. They not only let him return to Béjar, but they sent a trusted squaw with him, and on the way she confided, That other camp, 2 days south, they have two of the children taken in the big raid. They detoured, and Damián found that what the woman said was true. A boy of 10 and a girl of 8 were in the tents, and Damián persuaded the Apache to release the latter so that she could return to her people. But the child refused to leave. Her people were dead, she had seen them die, and now she had found other parents in the camp. But God wants you to live a decent life within the church, Damián argued. Leave her alone, the boy snarled, grabbing her away. My son, it is proper that she... get away. In some curious fashion, the children were blaming the friar for the terrible things that had happened to them, and this Damián could not accept. Reaching for the girl, he drew her to him, and with a trembling forefinger traced the scars across her face. Put there, not in the heat of battle, but by Apache braves who tortured their captives, even the children. What is your name, child of heaven? Let her go, the boy cried again, and this time he wrenched the girl away, struck her violently, and shoved her along to some older women, who began to beat her. Regardless of his own safety, Damian lunged toward the little girl to rescue her from such abuse. But he was halted by a tall, powerful Apache warrior, whose garb caused the friar to stop in horror. With the hand that had traced the girl's scars, he reached out and touched the man's garment, realizing that it was the robe Fray Domingo had been wearing prior to his horrible death. Holding on to the robe, he said quietly in Apache, "This is the garment of my friend. I must have it for his grave." The Indian understood and respected the emotion represented. "Your friend, very brave." Still clinging to the robe, Damian said, "You must let me take it. What will you give me?" Damian had nothing to offer but his mule, and this the Apache took gladly, for it would make a feast. So Fray Damian de Saldana returned to his mission on foot, trailing an Apache woman astride a donkey, and clutching to his bosom the robe in which his dearest friend and companion of many years had approached his martyrdom. His efforts to bring peace and Christianity to the Apache not only failed, they ended in repeated embarrassment. At the conclusion of his first venture into alien territory, after the Apache woman led him into Bejar, he persuaded Alvaro that the Apache were of sincere intent when they suddenly changed face and discussed the possibility of permanent truce, and he pointed out that with the Indians receiving French guns, it was imperative that a peaceful understanding be reached. So, against his better judgment, Captain Saldana agreed that Damian, with a new mule, should return with the woman and arrange for a plenary between Apache chiefs and Presidio soldiers. Damian, heartened by the possibility that he might be the agent for ending the raids and retaliations, returned to the western lands and persuaded his Apache to send for those who controlled the south. With delight he listened as the newcomers consented. "We'll go and talk, and if he's like you, a man of bravery, perhaps." A party of 16, led by Damian and the squaw who had made the earlier trip, rode east one March morning in 1736, arriving at Besar 4 days later. When the six missions were in sight, Damian and the woman rode on ahead, sounding signals that brought many men to the walls. Captain Alvaro, not at all certain that truce was possible, cautioned his men to remain alert, then nervously admitted the Apache into the presidio. In sign language, the Apache talked incessantly for 2 days, consuming a vast amount of food as they did. And at dusk on the second day, at a signal from their chief, they suddenly raised a war cry, slew the two guards, and ran outside to join some 90 more of their men who had crept close during the preceding days. They were a force powerful enough to have assaulted the presidio itself had they so decided. Instead, they drove off more than 120 Bejar horses, galloping westward into the shadows, whooping and screaming and firing their French guns in the air. Fray Damian was so distraught after this debacle, which he had unwittingly engineered, that he fell into a kind of trance, not insensible to those about him, but quite unable to talk or act. He lay on his straw palas, staring at the ceiling, indifferent to food, and from time to time calling out the word Domingo. But when attendants hurried to see what he wanted, they found him weeping and unable to speak further. His health deteriorated rapidly, and it was only the care of Benita, sent to the mission by Alvaro, that saved him. She was a woman of 32 now, and as lively in spirit as when Damian had first seen her promenading around the square at Zacatecas. Her eyes still glowed mischievously, and her skin remained unblemished, as if time were loath to touch something so flawless. Most surprising of all, under these deplorable circumstances, she still retained a cheerfulness that prevented her from taking troubles too seriously. "Come now, Damian, we need you in Behar," she said teasingly. Disregarding mission rules, she propped open the door to his cell, brought in flowers, and personally cooked nourishing meals for him. When he seemed to revive, with senses clarified so that he could understand what she was saying, she assured him that her husband did not blame him for the disaster with the Apache. They're savage brutes, and what could anyone expect? "I expected peace," Damian said. "No one should have been so easily deceived," she said. "Were you?" She reflected on this for some moments, then said the right thing. "No, but I love you for being such a dear, good man, and I prayed that you might be right." As soon as she said this, she realized that her words stressed the fact that he had been wrong, so she added quickly, "It's always good to try, Damian. Maybe another time." As he watched her move about his cell, he appreciated anew the miracle that, even though he was forbidden by church law to have her for himself, she was nevertheless a part of his being, a mystical wife in another world whose conventions he could not fathom. She was the woman he had loved from that first moment when he saw her laughing with the other girls, and that she should now be so close to him and mending his broken spirit was a joy he could share with no one, not even with Jesus Christ in his prayers. When Damian finally rose from his cot, a most pleasing honor awaited him. Simón Garza had finished his 14 Stations of the Cross, but their installation had been deferred until Damian could supervise it. Actually, all he did was stand in his adobe church and tell the workmen how to hang the carvings. But when the light fell across them, showing the marvelous detail Garza had achieved with his rude chisels, tears came to his eyes, and he fell to his knees and prayed. It seemed that God himself must have bent down and guided Garza's hand, for Damian could not conceive how an illiterate mestizo carpenter could otherwise have accomplished such a work. When the carvings were in place, Captain Alvaro, supported by friars from the other missions, told Damian, "We must have a celebration to dedicate your stations." And it was arranged that a cloth covering would be draped over each carving, and that Garza would move from one location to the next, pulling aside the cloth to reveal the beauty beneath. Damian would expound the religious significance, while the choir, trained by Fray Domingo, sang holy verses he had taught them. Fray Eusebio, still protesting that he was not worthy of such high honor, would represent the other missions. It was the culmination of Damian's custodianship. Indian women filled the rude church with flowers, and as the veils fell away and sunlight illuminated the carvings, Damian thought that Jesus Christ himself had come to Behar to relive those tragic, hallowed moments when he moved painfully along the road to Golgotha. Damian's exultation was short-lived, because when word of the episode with the Apache reached Mexico City, the viceroy cast about for a new governor of Tejas who would bring stricter order to the region. Unfortunately, he had no one available to send, but a conniving assistant who wanted to rid himself of a real incompetent whispered, "Excellency, why not send Frankis? He's a Canary Islander, and he'll know how to handle things." What a sad miscalculation. If one searched the archives to find an example of Spanish colonial policy at its worst, one would surely select Don Carlos Benitez Frankis de Lugo, a vain, arrogant, opinionated fop who never displayed a shred of either courage or discernment, but who did distinguish himself as one of the most inept and vengeful Spaniards ever to function overseas. In fact, he was too obtuse even to realize that his assignment to Tejas was a demotion, for he boasted to his friends, I'm to restore Spanish dignity in an area which has forgotten what discipline means. The character of his administration was defined when he reached San Luis Potosí, where he raged at the local garrison for not having fired enough salutes to honor a dignitary of his exalted stripe. I am, after all, governor of Tejas. At Saltillo, he abused the entire establishment, because not all the officials were lined up to meet him as he entered town. But he reserved his most ridiculous behavior for San Juan Bautista, a hard-working post with limited amenities. He was so incensed by the lack of spit and polish in the presidio that he dismissed everyone on the spot, and then had to hire them back when he learned that no replacements could reach the forlorn outpost in less than a year. In Tejas, he took immediate dislike to the Saldaña brothers, accusing Fray Damián of being tardy in asking Zacatecas for a replacement for Fray Domingo, and of deepening the Santa Teresa ditch without written authority. But his special scorn was reserved for Captain Alvaro, whom he denigrated as follows. Through errant cowardice, he failed to protect the ranch of Misión Santa Teresa against the Apache, causing the blessed Fray Domingo, may God smile upon his martyrdom, to lose his life most horribly. Later, acting without reason or military competence, he allowed the very Apache who killed Fray Domingo, may God smile upon his martyrdom. He became so indignant as he composed this report, he ended by convincing himself that Alvaro was a cowardly incompetent. Handcuff the recreant and throw him in jail, being sure that his legs are tightly chained. To demonstrate his own heroism, he organized a hastily put together expedition to subdue the Apache. About 50 Spaniards and their poorly armed helpers against 10,000 scattered Apache. And his troops would have been annihilated had not Simón Garza and two Utah scouts detected a concentration of warriors hiding in a mountain pass and prevailed upon the governor to beat a disorganized retreat. As it was, the Apache overtook three stragglers and tortured them viciously. In this sad year of 1736, Tejas saw Spanish occupancy at its worst. Travel between Béjar and the distant capital at Los Adais was interdicted by the Apache. Food was scarce, because the irrigation ditches, without Damián's supervision, were not functioning properly, and all else was in disarray because so many of the able administrators languished in jail with chains about their legs. It was in this ugly setting that Fray Damián proved what a quintessential Spaniard he was. The first responsibility of any man, even before his duty to God, was to protect his own family. Lands for his son, a husband for his daughter, a job for his nephew, an appointment for his brother-in-law, these were the obligations of a Spanish man. He was so outraged by the arrest of his brother, and so distraught by what might happen to Benita and her three sons, who were, after all, like his own, that he devised a procedure that would have delighted Machiavelli, for he used stamped paper stolen from the presidio on which to press it. Respected Archbishop Fisarón, congratulations on your great success as viceroy of all Mexico. The king could have chosen no one better fitted for that exalted position, and I stand ready as a humble friar to assist you in all you do. My brother, Captain Alvaro de Saldaña of the Saldañas of Saldaña, has served bravely on the frontier, and I believe there is a law which states that an officer who has seen active duty in any new territory is entitled to 6 leagues of crown lands upon retirement. On behalf of my brother, now occupied with other matters, I beg you to make this award. There is, a few miles west of here, in a bend of the Medina, a stretch of land called Rancho El Codo, once occupied by the ranch of this mission. It has now been abandoned because of Apache raids, and is of no practical use to anyone until the Apache are subdued. My brother and his wife, in years to come, can tame this land if you will cede it to them now, in reward for the hard work they have completed on the frontier of your dominion.